Super late tonight, picking apples, making pies, pulling something in our lemonade, and taking with us, we're half away in our fake empire. We're half away in our fake empire. Tiptoe through our shiny city with our diamond slippers on. Do our gay ballet on ice, bluebirds on our shoulders. We're half away in our fake empire. We're half away in our fake empire.
God, I pray you help us to see compulsions that we have today, oftentimes as ways that are substituting for seeing you for a great, great entity, a great being that loves us. Father, my words, I pray that they would cut to the heart of who we are. You'd help us eliminate the fog that's in our minds as it comes to understanding you. So many of us just have a hard time seeing you for who you really are. We see you the way someone else described us, or the way we wish you were, but we don't really see the real you. So help us today to have that happen and speak in all that you do. And I pray these things in your name. Amen. Fake empire. Yes, there's many things that we have that we build our lives around. It's our fake empire. We have different things that we lean on, different things that are crutches. But we never have that feeling, or rarely have that feeling, where we're home, where we are with God, where we are content, where we are joyful. And this is where we are in our journey today. I know last week I've had a couple small groups. Small groups have been going great, from what I understand from different people I know. I'm in a couple small group and a men's small group. And one of the small groups that I was in, I identified as one of my issues, one of my things that describes me. On page 19 is I spend a lot of time thinking about how I look. And specifically, I was thinking how I look as a pastor. Sometimes people think I shouldn't be doing that because that's what I do for a living, or I should be doing that. They put me in some mold as what they think a pastor should look. And I spend time thinking that through, even if I rebel against it. And so I went to what my very next challenge was to wear the same shirt 2 days in a row. 3 days in a row if I'm super hardcore. So I guess it was a literal thinking about people, how people think that I look. And so I did a challenge that wasn't really true to who I was, but nonetheless, it was a good challenge. I found interesting as I was walking around, people would say, didn't you just wear that outfit yesterday? Which is actually not that unusual for me, you know, but I wear various things twice, but rarely a shirt twice anyway. And I found it interesting to explain to somebody who really wasn't part of this whole thing called The Journey what this was about, like doing a challenge to grow and learn something. Because here's what's great as we do this together. You are very rare. You are in the upper echelon right now. Let's think about it. How many of us, once we get past high school or once we get past college, are in a growth environment? Many of us were in those environments we were growing only because somebody was forcing us to. Very few people ever take a training regimen on their life to improve themselves, to look at things differently, to grow themselves. So hey, way to go, way to go, way to be in this. It's really good and really, I think, fulfilling, or going to be anyway. Now today we're going to look at some of the things that Jesus taught, some of the things that he experienced, and we're going to come in contact with things that you might not have understood about God before. That's the big idea today. At this point in the journey, we need to start to see that our image of who God is might not be the image of who he really is, and specifically, his image as a father. As a father, last week we used a passage where it likened God to a nursing mother. So obviously God doesn't have genitalia. It's not saying that God is man or woman, but the dominant way that describes God in the Bible is as a father. And I found that people who have a hard time reckoning and seeing God as father in the Bible, they think it's a very narrow view in the Bible, or it's kind of chauvinistic or some such thing. As I talk with folks like that, a lot of them over the years, I found invariably those who have a hard time seeing God as father had an earthly father they were disconnected from. Always. Always. I don't want to see God as a father. Why does it have to show him as a father? Always comes from a place of my dad was physically absent, or he was emotionally absent, or he was physically hurtful, or he was emotionally hurtful. And this just shows that we sort of put our dad stuff on God. And some of our dads were a really great picture of who God is, and some of our parents or our guardians or our dads were not a good picture of who God was. Jesus had an amazing day with his heavenly father. I think it was the best day of his life. I think it was. Here's what it was. In Luke chapter 3, 21 to 22, it says this. When Jesus had been baptized and he was praying, the heavens were opened and the Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form like a dove, and a voice came from heaven. You are my beloved son. With you, I'm well pleased. Man, how great would it be to hear God say to you, you're my beloved daughter. You're my beloved son. With you, I'm well pleased. Other translations say, you make me happy. You bring me pleasure. I think it's the best day in Jesus' life. I really do. I think this was more thrilling than his biggest crowd he ever spoke to. I think it was more authenticating than any powerful miracle he worked. The words from his earthly father, in you I'm well pleased. Let me tell you something. Many of us are longing to hear that from a dad, from a mom, from an authority figure to say, hey, in you I'm well pleased. You've done well, son. Daughter, I'm thankful for you. You make me happy. I'm proud of you. Very few people ever hear that. I haven't heard that. Wish I did. Hadn't heard that. I bring my parents here to Crossroads, and they'll come, and I think, oh, gosh, maybe they'll say, well, Brian, good job, man, amazing. I don't know all you did or what your role was, but, man, we're proud of you. No, when they come to Crossroads, I hear, why is the music so loud? I don't understand why the music's got to be so, and why is it so dark in there? I don't understand why it's so dark in there. It would be awesome to have all of us be able to have the affirmation of Father, say, hey, son, in you I'm well pleased. And here's the thing, until you feel that God, let's forget about our mom or our dad for a second, until you feel that God approves of you, you will never be at home. Until you feel that where you are right now, God says, I approve of you, well done, you made me happy, you will never, never be at home. The amazing thing about this is Jesus at this point, he hasn't given any big talks, he hasn't had any awesome teachings, and all the miracles that you know of, he hasn't done them yet. So in and of his identity, God gives him approval, says to him, you make me happy. Scott Fajita. He's from the New Orleans Saints, a middle linebacker. I'm not sure if it's Fajita or Fajita. I'm not sure which, but I'm sure he got picked on a lot. Actually, probably not. He's big enough to beat up anybody who picked on him. But he was responding negatively to an authority figure as Roger Goodell of the NFL, who handed out sanctions against him and others for the headhunting thing that the New Orleans Saints went through. And he was really bothered by this authority figure kind of giving him a reprimand. Here's what he says. He says, for him to come out and say he was disappointed in me for not standing up to my coach, Fajita said after practice Wednesday, I haven't had someone tell me they were disappointed in me since I was 12 years old, and that was my father. You kind of sense there's little daddy issues here, can't you? It's kind of like what my dad did or didn't do. Now I'm projecting it onto Roger Goodell, and I'm telling you, we project, all of us do, we project whatever happened in our family, we project it onto God, and I want us to consider that it may not have been healthy, it may not have been accurate. Jesus, after he gets approval and affirmation, for having done nothing, by the way, again, he hasn't been a knight, he's been good, no question, he's God, okay, but he hasn't done amazing things that he's well known for. And yet he is approved of. From there, he goes away into the wilderness for 40 days, or the desert. It's called a wilderness because it's not like the Sahara Desert. It's rocky and it's hilly, arid. He goes away for 40 days, and he is tempted. And what is he tempted on? He's tempted on his core identity as a son who his father approves of. His son, a son who God says, you bring me pleasure, in you I'm well pleased. And so the evil one, also known as the devil or the Satan, comes to him to tempt him after 40 days, and he comes to him when he's at his lowest. He's gone without food and water for 40 days. This is a miraculous thing. You can't go humanly without water for 40 days. You can food, but not water. Jesus is able to do this, and at the end of it, at its worst time, after 40 days, he gets tempted. Here's what it says. The evil one says, if you are the Son of God, command this stone to become bread. And Jesus answered him, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone. Now, what is the temptation? Is the temptation bread? No. Look at how it starts. If you're the Son of God. If. This is a temptation of identity. This is a temptation of where you are home. He gives three temptations here. All of these temptations are the temptations that all of us will wrestle with. One of these is probably and likely your core temptation, and it is the core temptation that takes you away from home. It's the core temptation that keeps you from feeling the pleasure of God, feeling His approval. This first one is, prove it by satisfying your appetite. Turn these stones into bread. It is appetite. Appetite, ambition, and approval. Appetite. Why is it that 2 out of 3 Americans are overweight or obese? I mean, it's partially due to we have a discipline problem. It's partially due to McDonald's and supersizing and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, all those things are at play to some degree or another. But really, the spiritual essence of it is when you have an appetite that is out of control, it's because there's something inside that is out of order. There's some lack of approval that you're feeling. There's something that you're lacking that you're trying to make up with. That's why we call it comfort food. You know, when we're sick, we'll have a little chicken noodle. It's comfort food. Well, for some, food is the appetite by which they comfort all of their afflictions, all of our temptations. Don't feel one with God. We feel, as we looked at last week, orphaned. Orphans, one of the ways that we as orphans try to make ourselves feel better, feel okay, feel at home, is through our appetite. And it might not be food either. It might be alcohol. I know some people who have an appetite of needing more and more and more and more of working out. It can be working out. An appetite for working out. An appetite for having that buzz. An appetite for always having a body that's better than it was last month. It could be an appetite for caffeine. It could be an appetite for knowledge and degrees. I know some people, unless they're getting a degree, it could be, I know a guy I've ridden with before. He's one of these adventure junkies. Whether it's hiking, climbing, skiing, whatever it is, he said to me, exact quote, he said, if there's not a chance of death, then it's not fun for me. Exact quote. If there's not a chance for death, then it's not fun for me. He has an appetite, an addiction, if you will, for adrenaline that comes through that sort of thing. Social media, iPhone. Some of us right now are going, oh, iPhone. I just mentioned iPhone or smartphone. You're going, oh, I probably ought to check it right now. It can oftentimes go into that thing because there's something inside of us that's missing. Blaise Pascal, the great French mathematician and follower of Jesus, said this: "What else does this craving and this helplessness proclaim but that there was once in man a true happiness of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are. Though none can help, since his infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object, in other words, by God himself." No matter how much we're tempted, no matter how much our appetite is screaming, food will not fill the God-shaped vacuum. Alcohol will not fill the God-shaped vacuum. Sex will not fill the God-shaped vacuum. Social media, working out, religious duties. I mean, these will not fill that vacuum. Only God himself, in his approval and knowing, he says, "Son, daughter, I'm well pleased in you. You make me happy." When you come to a place where you can reside in that and it isn't tied to anything you've done, purely who God believes you to be, you go to a new place. You have found your place called home. The evil one loses that temptation. Jesus does not turn the stones into bread. He is having his nourishment be his identity as a favored son. So the next one happens this way. "And the devil took him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And he said to him, 'To you I will give all this authority and their glory, for it's been delivered to me, and I will give it to whom I will. If you then worship me, it will all be yours.' And Jesus answered him, 'It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve.'" Takes up and shows them all the kingdoms of the world. I've been to this place. There's a there's the Jordan River, where they believe, scholars believe this took place. Jordan River, which is way smaller than it used to be. And then there's a high kind of bluff right there that's a rocky, craggy, desert kind of area. And they believe perhaps in this high area, Jesus had a vision of everything he could see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. And the idea of, if you will worship me, in other words, your identity not to be a worshiper of God, but your identity to be a worshiper of me, I'll give you all of this. Anything you can see, you can have. Anything you could do, you could do. You can succeed at all of it. This is the temptation of ambition. For those of us who wrestle with the temptation of ambition, this is the core way that we anesthetize this, these process of appetite, ambition, and approval. These are the three ways we anesthetize, another A word there, and these three ways we anesthetize not feeling at home. Three ways we anesthetize that we don't feel like God is enough for us, that God is for us, that God loves us, that we actually have his approval. And one of them is ambition. Always conquering. Always the next hill. Can't have any time to celebrate what we've done already. There's another hill to hit. For many, this may take form in the accrual of wealth. Must always have more and more and more, because money is the scorecard of our ambition of how well we're doing. Some of us, our ambition is in degrees. I mean, I've known people that, man, they've always got to be worked to some new degree or something. It's ambition through degrees. Others of us, it's mindless climbing in the business world. Any promotion we take, any possibility to get ahead, we do it without any thought of our family or whether or not that job actually fits us and our long-term goals. Actually, because our only long-term goals is getting ahead. Because the further we get, the more we feel we've actualized ourselves. I've known some people who have lost fortunes as a result of their ambition because they made the top of the mountain in their business sector, but there was nowhere to go. They had to find another to climb, and they weren't well suited for it, and they lost scads of money because their ambition could never say, "I've done well, let's just maintain this and keep going." There's always got to be a new hill to conquer, always something that has to happen, and always endless comparison to others. I have to keep being ambitious because I always see somebody who's better off than me, who's further on down the line from me. Has there ever been enough for you? Ever? One of the ways that you also know that you're able to overcome these temptations is when you go without something. Like, what is it in your life that if you took it away for a week, you couldn't handle it? your iPhone or your, you know, your, I don't know, what was there anything, if you took away, you couldn't handle it. There's something that's happening there that might not be healthy. I've gone 7 days without food before, intentionally. I've done that a number of times. I'll tell you, the hardest 7-day fast I ever did, though, was 7-day fast from motorcycles. Not riding, not working on it, not researching a new trip, not anything. It kind of filled space for me that I realized, oh man, it's good to separate myself from that every once in a while. Is there anything for you that you could not go without 7 days for? It's not that that thing isn't a good thing. It's that that thing might be trying to tell you that it can do for you what only God can do for you, and it's not true. It's a lie. The evil one could not do for Jesus what only his heavenly Father could do for him. The next temptation. And he took him to Jerusalem and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you're the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. For it's written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you. And on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against the stone." And Jesus answered him, "It is said, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test." We don't know if he took him literally to the top of the temple or if this was sort of some vision, some 3D magic that was happening in his psyche. But nonetheless, he's way, way up high and he's ready to throw himself down, sort of like the thrill of bungee jumping except without a bungee. Throw yourself down right now. How awesome would that be? I've never gone bungee jumping. I'm not sure if I ever will or not, but I think it'd be really cool to do. How cool would it be to bungee jump without any bungee, and just before you splat the ground, angels come and hold you up? Oh, it's kind of like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, you know, in that one scene where he's, you know, whoosh, he's down on the bottom of the thing, and the little guide wires are holding him up. Jesus would feel so authenticated if he did this. It would be crazy. Can you imagine how much approval you would feel if God said, "Oh no, you just tried to kill yourself. No, no, I'm going to have angels stop you before you hit the ground." You say, "Oh man, God must really need me, doesn't he? Man, he must really need me and be approving of me." This would be the ultimate way to authenticate that Jesus heard that he was the Son and he was pleased right there. But he didn't need to do it. He chose not to fall to that trick because he wanted to rest in his identity. He heard it. He knew it. He was at home with it. When your core temptation is approval, every decision is made through the eyes of whether or not so-and-so will approve. What will they think? What will she think? What will my dad think? What will my mom think? Some of us are in careers right now because we're trying to satisfy and please our parents. Some of us are in careers right now because we want to do the exact opposite things our parents said. It was sort of like the anti-approval. We see this happening in our society all over the place. I read of a guy down in Florida who died because he won a contest by eating cockroaches and superworms. The most cockroaches and superworms inside of like a minute or something like that at this pet store. He ate it, and then he fell over and died. Dead. What compels a person who's always described as the life of the party, who wins eating contests? I have to think he's wanting to get approval any way he possibly can. Hazing, it's a massive issue. You know, the recent student in college where the band hazed him and he died and all that kind of stuff. I thought that was just supposed to happen amongst fraternities, amongst football players or something like that. My goodness, it's happening in the band as well? What is it about somebody who wants approval so much that they would drink themselves silly, puke themselves silly, all to get the approval of people who they're not even spending any time with in 5 years? They're not even going to know them. What is that? What's driven that from us is that we don't feel God's approval. We don't feel that. We don't feel that he, so we need it from someplace else. We need that instant gratification. It's part of why it's so tragic when we lose our job. We've lost our source of approval, our source of identity. See, it's not just the job, maybe. It's not just the hazing. It's the deeper stuff. And when we get a picture of who God is, picture of one who says, "Man, in you, you make me happy. I find pleasure." This is where Jesus' strength came from. Here's the thing about Jesus. This was bad for 40 days, but guess what? His worst days were yet to come. In fact, let me tell you, I don't know if anyone's ever told you this before. your worst days are yet to come. Some of you are sitting there going, whoa, what are you telling me? I thought I was in a mega church and they're supposed to always make me feel happy. What do you mean? Aren't you supposed to say your best days are yet to come? Maybe. But I tell you what also, your worst days are also to come. Your worst days are yet to come. Boy, doesn't that make you feel happy? Woo! I'm sorry, just a little dose of reality for you. Seriously, your worst days are yet to come. And what will get you through those worst days, what got Jesus through his worst days, his identity as a son who was favored. His identity and knowledge of the God who really was, not the pop cultural understanding of God, the God who really was. Now, this happens in the book of Luke. It actually happens a few different times. And then Jesus repeats the essence of God's character by giving maybe his best illustration ever, his best story ever. You might know it as the prodigal son. Even if you've not been to church or haven't read the Bible, you might know it as the prodigal son. Even though the term prodigal son is never used in the story at all, we know it as the prodigal son. Actually, it should be known as the man who has two sons. Actually, it starts out Luke chapter 15, verse 11 to 12. Here's what Jesus says. There was a man who had two sons. So this is a story about a man and two sons. It's not a story about a prodigal son. It's a story about a man and two sons. This man is a father, and this father represents God. And there's two sons. There is a younger son who is visibly rebellious, who runs away. And there is an older son who is internally rebellious and stays around. And the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of property that's coming to me." And he divided his property between them. Now, interesting. In ancient cultures, or even today's culture, if somebody was to come to a dad and say, or a mom, and say, "Can I have my inheritance right now, please?" In ancient Middle Eastern cultures, what would be said is this: "I'd rather have you dead. I want your money instead of you. I don't want to wait around until you kick the bucket. I'd rather have you." And actually, this is the way many of us as orphans feel. If we actually were honest about it and we were in touch with ourselves, we actually would rather have the gifts of God than the face of God. We would actually rather have the hand of God than the actual identity of God. We want the blessings and the drippings from God, but we're not really sure we want a relationship with God. This is very common. It's not an American thing that's just right now. It's a common thing in all societies at all time, including back then. When the son says, "Right now, just give me the inheritance and I'll be on my way." And he does. He takes half of his holdings, gives it to his son, and his son goes away. And as Jesus tells the story, he blows on wine, women, and song. He just parties hardy, he buys prostitutes, he drinks hard, he does anything he wants to do, he does it. Now, it could be that this is an appetite issue. He's got appetites of things, he feels his dad has been keeping away from him, he wants to actually go and do his appetite. It could be he was going and investing in businesses, trying to be a wild success on his own and partying hard at night. It could be his ambitions. It could be for some reason while he was interacting with his brother, he didn't feel approval, even though he might have been approved of. Maybe he didn't feel it, so maybe he's going out because he's got to feel that somebody will approve him. We're not sure what's going on, but he's taken off. Jesus, again, has made up this story to tell us the truth about ourselves and to tell us the truth about God. As he goes out and as he totally blows all of his money, he finds himself at his lowest of lowest. He's feeding pigs. This is a Jewish culture. He's, you know, is assumably a Jew. Jesus was a Jew. And for a Jew to be in an unkosher profession like feeding pigs, the most unkosher food that there is, would have been an abomination. He's the lowest of the lowest. It symbolizes the complete retreat from his religion, the complete abandonment of any spirituality or any underpinning he might have had in the home. And as he's feeding these pigs, here's what happens. "I will arise and I'll go to my father. I'll say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. He says, my father's servants eat better than I do. As he thinks this through, so that I could stay here slaving and not eating as well, or go back as a hired hand to my dad. I know he hires people. Maybe he'll hire me back. And just if you would give me enough grace that I could earn a living in his business, that'd be fine by me. See, he doesn't really believe he's a child of his father anymore. He's fully assumed the identity of an orphan. I forfeited it all. It's gone. I'm gone. I made the deal. I made the break. There's no approval for me. My dad is not going to be happy to see me. He has no warm affection towards me at all. Every once in a while, I wish I didn't know the Bible. It'd be fun to read things in the Bible and you don't know how it's going to turn out, you know? It'd be fun to go, oh, could I be reading this right now? If you haven't heard the story, this is awesome, because you got to be thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, how humiliating would that be? It's got to now go back to the guy we thought, he told him he'd rather have him dead, and oh my, is the guy going to punch him? Is he going to kick him out? Is he going to ignore him and say, you're dead to me? What's going to happen is Jesus unweaving this thing. We can lose the character and identity of God because we think we know how the story is going to go. We've got to live in the tension here. This is an orphan. This is an orphan who has violated his dad, who has abused his dad, who's walked away with his dad, who's dwindled away everything that was good that his dad gave him. And yet he's in such a hard way, he makes his way back to God. He makes his way back to dad. And here's what it says. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him. And he ran, and he embraced him, and he kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe, put it on him. Put a ring in his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he is found. And they began to celebrate it. Not the way anyone would have pictured it to be. I mean, this father could have done a number of things, but to welcome him back and actually give him a place of honor, get the signet ring, the one that I use to stamp the wax seals when I do business dealings that represents my wealth, put that on his finger. The robe that represents royalty, put that around him. Shoes, my goodness, boy, get some shoes on your head. Get him some great shoes right now. The fatted calf, the one we've been getting ready for amazing celebration, today is the celebration. Wow. Wow. Is this the picture of God you have? You leave, you're unfaithful, and he celebrates you? I find that many of us have problems because we have a problem with the true identity of God. I hear people who don't know the identity of God all the time. They'll say things like, well, you know, the God of the Old Testament, oh, I don't like that guy. I go, have you ever read the Old Testament? You ought to try reading it sometime instead of just listening to the critics. Because the God that I see in the Old Testament is amazingly gracious. We see this justice element of God come up, this wrath element definitely fire up, but it's always at the end of over and over and over and over taking it, over and over. And finally, to satisfy justice and maintain some integrity, he must discipline. In the book of Hosea, he has a prophet marry a prostitute. And he says, Hosea, I want you to marry this prostitute, and everyone's going to see, why in the world are you in a relationship with somebody who whores around on you? And it's because I am married to people who whore around on me. And I want everyone to see it, that I don't leave, that I stay and I'm faithful, and you're supposed to stay, and you're supposed to be faithful. In Hosea chapter 2, 13 to 14, it says this, she adorned my people. They adorned herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares the Lord. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. I'll bring her into the wilderness and I'll speak tenderly to her. I will allure her. That's amazing tenderness of God that is always in pursuit of you, who always wants you no matter what. Now, as this younger son, his mind is blown, because he's taken on the identity of an orphan, and orphans don't just receive stuff. I mean, you got to work for it. And the guy said, no, you're coming back in. You're right in my graces. I want to be in relationship. I want you right now. Meanwhile, the older brother's watching this. The older brother's going, what in the world? I hear all this cacophony of sound. I heard a pig squeal. You're killing that the fatted calf. What is going on? You're kidding. He's back. He's back. The guy who hated our family, hated my dad, was totally unfaithful. He's back. And this older brother wants to have nothing to do with the celebration. It says this: he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I've served you." There's another translation that says, "I've slaved for you. I've been slaving for you all these years, and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. I might have a kegger out in the hillside somewhere. You never let me do that. But when this son of yours," notice it's this son of yours, not this brother of mine, not this loved human being, "this son of yours, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him." So this looks like a faithful son. Looks like the one is the rebellious son who goes away. This is the older son. He looks like the faithful son. He's not faithful. At least he's not faithful to an identity of being at home with God. Can you see that both of them are gone? The younger son is physically gone. The older son is emotionally gone. Slaving, this son of yours. I mean, there's no sense of warmth that he has around his dad. Both of these sons are spiritually gone because both of these sons have a bad picture of who their father is. They don't see the identity of their loving father who wants to give approval. The younger son thinks that his actions make him worthy. The older son thinks his actions make him worthy. Both of them are wrong. The younger son, his actions didn't make him unworthy of the love of God. And the older son, his actions didn't make him worthy of the love of God either. It wasn't their actions. They're both deluded. It's their identity as sons, feeling at home, knowing the character of their father, and drawing strength from that. The younger son is, and by the way, hopefully you're starting to notice which default you are. All of us by default are one of these two. The younger brothers in us tend to be relativistic. There's a whole world out there. You know, why would I stay around in church around there? There's a whole world out there, and you have your truth, I have my truth. The younger son is very relativistic, just kind of goes out and has his own moral code. The older son is very moralistic. And whether you're relativistic or whether you're moralistic, neither of those are realistic to the heart and the character of God. Younger brother, home wasn't home for him. It was just a holding station until he could experience the big bad world. And for the older brother, home wasn't home to him. It was a job. It was a job where you hit a paycheck. Older brothers amongst us tend to be the ones that maybe serve the most, tithe even, make game change commitments. We do it because, some of us do it because we feel like this is the way I keep God on my side. I keep him approving of me by my spiritual ambition. And some of us as younger brothers might have actually come back and maybe you serve and maybe you tithe because you're trying to work off your debt from before. Because you're playing those rules. No, that's not the way your Heavenly Father works. We're going to go back into depth in this story in a couple weeks. But I just wanted to help you see that this is the identity of the Father that Jesus knew, who he heard say to him, "You're my son, in whom I'm well pleased, the one who hasn't done anything that would impress anybody, but you impress me because you're mine and because I love you." Psalm 149:4, the last verse I'll share with you. "The Lord takes pleasure in his people. He adorns the humble with salvation." The Lord takes pleasure in you as child and you as son. He adorns the humble with salvation. He doesn't adorn the moralistic with salvation. He doesn't adorn the religious right with the salvation. He doesn't adorn the well-disciplined people with salvation. He doesn't adorn those who have a high duty and honor with salvation. He adores the humble with salvation. The younger brother was humble. He made that turn. He said, "Father, I just need to see you for who you are, and I just need you." I want you to know, your Father takes pleasure in you. Your Father takes pleasure in you. And it's those who are humble that he says, "You bring me pleasure." in you I'm well pleased. When you get that with God, you are on the path away from orphanhood and to God. You are to a place where there is strength and stability for your highest of highs, for your lowest of lows, where stuff just starts. It is beautiful. It's powerful. In a moment, we're going to have Mark and Mason come up, and Mason and Terry and Florence come up and walk us through the guide. I'm going to do this here as well, but first let's just pray. God, thank you for today. And just the beautiful picture of who you are. There's so many images of you that just are inaccurate or just plain wrong. None of them stack up to the depth of your love, the depth of your forbearance, the depth of your faithfulness. Help us to know you, the God who really is. And in that process, come to be the children that feel your favor. Amen.